folks, it's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here.
Mike Costantino right over here. I can say my name wrong anytime I want.
Yeah, and you've got your hat off today.
Mike, I did take my hat off because we're on Facebook.
Yeah.
And, you know, I put the hat on, so everybody says, hey, nice hat.
Yeah. Take another look at the screen there, Mike.
Yeah, there he is,
folks.
There it is.
And we have a special guest today.
We do have a special guest.
Paul Lenz. He's a professor.
Say it again.
Paul Lenz?
Yeah.
Say that again?
Yeah,
okay.
That's good. And we said it too fast.
All right. I said it too fast?
Hypercritical this morning, yes. I woke up hypercritical.
You're just evil. Okay?
Paul Lenz
is a professor of politics and international affairs up at NAU. He's been on the show several times before. He has a really good book you guys could buy for only $65.
Yes.
The price is not the issue. It's the subject matter.
That's right. It's the content. We're talking about content.
So how many books have you written now?
I've written two that are out and then one that will be out later this year.
And what's the last one on?
The last one is on the Iranian nuclear deal. It's called Nuclear Optics.
Tell us a little bit about that. That one I didn't know about.
It's a book that I did with my colleague Khalid Tagma up at NAU in our department, where we look at the Iranian nuclear deal.
Excuse me, Paul. You have to say her name again. Could you say your colleague's name?
My colleague, his name is Khalid Tagma.
Tagma, thank you. You said it too fast.
Oh, I apologize. I've had a lot of coffee this morning.
Okay. Yes. And apparently Mike has not.
Right.
So Mike, drink some of that coffee so you can pick up on this thing.
So it's about the Iranian nuclear deal and then examination of the deal through various international relations theories about why the deal happened and why it failed.
And what are the different theories? What are the different takes on it, Paul?
So there's neorealism, so it's about power politics, neoliberal institutionalism. So the nuclear deal, the JCPOA by the Obama administration, was done because these institutions help to promote cooperation. There's a world systems theory perspective, which uses Marxism to say that it's about domination of the United States over states within the Middle East to try and get them to do their will, going back to the time of British and French colonialism. The other perspectives are what we call a three-level game, where the advisors within each of the administrations in the Obama administration, but also in the Iranian government, that they were aware of the dynamics involved in making this deal possible or not, and so their communications with each other influences what happens.
Oh, interesting. So out of all these perspectives, mm-hmm. which is your favorite?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it a favorite, but the one that I think plays quite a bit of an influence is the realpolitik, the realist perspective, but also the bureaucratic politics perspective as well. It plays a huge role. Because
a lot of it is power politics.
I believe so, yes, absolutely.
Years ago, I knew a Yemeni diplomat, and I was bartending across from the UN, and he was the smartest of the diplomats I saw. And he believed he was famous for defending the Israelis, which from an Arab guy was really strange, and people noticed it in the bar. And his theory was that it was all sort of a British conspiracy. It was all power politics. He was a Marxist communist from South Yemen, so he didn't hate anybody ethnically or religiously, but he thought it was all power politics and sort of really almost comic book exaggeration of what power politics and British American interests would be like. And he used to, you know, we used to argue at the bar and talk to him, and Very, very smart man. I don't know what happened. It was right before the reunification of Yemen from mm-hmm. South and socialist South Yemen with North Yemen.
Let me mention what we're doing this morning on Democratic Perspective. We, because we do a lot of different things here. And last week we did an Old Town show. We're talking about just a fun discussion of a commercial part of yeah. Cottonwood. This week we're talking about, we got Paul Enns. We got this expert from Middle East foreign policy from the Department of Politics and International Affairs, a distinguished professor. Last week we had George and Jim on, and distinguished in almost nothing.
So I guess the theme, Mike and Paul, is that we wanted to talk to you about American foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East under the Trump administration. And I've heard two basic theories out there, Mike. One is that the Trump administration is just kind of an incompetent version of traditional American foreign policy in the Middle East. And another that is some sort of radically different policy. But it's really, one argument is it's really not all that different. The power politics stuff we're doing is not really all that different than what we did, softer hand under Obama.
The foreign policy that the United States has had in the Middle East has been the same in the Trump administration as it was under Obama, under George W. Bush, under Clinton, under Reagan. It's just where they choose to emphasize the relationships and which allies they deem the most important.
Can you characterize it further? What is American foreign policy in the Middle East? What's the drivers of it? What's driving
sure.
it?
Sure. American foreign policy in the Middle East for many years has been about the promotion of self-determination and democracy, so protecting the state of Israel because they were our democratic ally in the region. But it's also to ensure the free flow of oil into the global economy, so to ensure the protection of oil and gas, as well as trying to cut down on the amount of what's called transnational terrorism, so groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, trying to prevent them from having a safe haven, especially since 9/11.
So why is the focus now is a conflict? I guess it's being led publicly by the Saudis, but also supported by the Israelis and pretty much all the other Sunni Arab countries against Iran. And the Iran-Arab conflict is heated up. Is that why is that happening? Because as we were talking before the show, Iran would seem to have limited opportunities to either expand or to expand its influence.
Well, after the United States invaded Iraq in 2003 and overthrew Saddam Hussein, it allowed for Iran to continue a foreign policy, a defensive balance of power type foreign policy, where it supported the Shia politicians and the various political groups that were developing within Iran. I'm sorry, within Iraq. It helped to support them against United States interests, and
as everybody said it would, by the way.
Absolutely, yes.
Everybody told the Bush administration not to do that because you'll upset this balance. Yeah.
The joke is that Iran won the Iraqi war, not the United States, because they ended up with more influence, Paul, than they had before it?
Yes, because what it allowed them to do is protect their interests in Iraq, which was now going to be loyal to them, because for many years, as you both know, Saddam Hussein, who was a Sunni, had launched a war against Iran after the Islamic Republic was created in 79. So this allowed for Iran to exact revenge and influence in a state next to it. It continued that relationship with Hafez al-Assad in Iran, as well as helping to support Hezbollah, the rebel group turned political party in Lebanon, to create what Professor Vali Nasser at Johns Hopkins has called the Shia Crescent. So basically allows for Iran to extend its influence to the Shia minority groups throughout the Middle East to challenge the Saudi monarchy.
So it's really about Iran defending and expanding its influence among Shia minorities in all these countries. Most folks, yes. That the by large, I don't know what the percentage is, Paul, but maybe 80% of the Muslims in the world are Sunni, and the other 20% are various kinds of Shia. And Syria has a large Shia population. And so does in Iran. I mean, Iraq had a majority population. So it seems natural that they would support their co-religionists, but it also is just pure power politics, Paul. I mean, that's where they can get support, power, support for whatever their foreign policy is.
Yes, absolutely. Their goal is to challenge the Saudi support of the Sunni rebel groups in Syria. You know, so that's why Iran would continue to support Bashar Assad and his fight against these rebel groups. It also allows for the Russians to come in and assist Iran in challenging the presence of the U.S. and the Saudis in Syria and as well in Yemen as well.
It sounds very much like, I'll leave it to you to answer it. Sounds very much like traditional power politics. It has a religious veneer, but it's really a lot of traditional power politics based on religion. And what we see in Europe is it starts out as religious wars, and then it gets all mixed up. And then a Protestant prince supports a Catholic prince, and then it just breaks down into power politics.
Yes, a number of these regional actors will use the ethnic differences, the religious differences, and they'll use it to suit their purposes. But in the end, a lot of it is about survival. It is about power politics. You know, Assad was very famous. Both Hafez and Bashar have been very famous in using religion when it suited their purposes to try and win support, but also to say that, hey, we need all of you other Syrians to come join with us and fight against these terrorists. That's why they consider the Sunni rebel groups as terrorists. They're fighting a war on terror, just as we have been fighting a war on terror. They use that moniker for their own purposes.
And I know that the Assad government had support among the religious minorities in Syria, I think, a lot because they were afraid of emerging Sunni majority taking over. So there's had a lot of support among the Druze and the Shia and Christian groups in Syria, and they used those minorities to play against this fear of a Sunni majority. What do Americans need to know? Because we were talking about earlier about the show, Mike, there's almost no debate about foreign policy, even among Democrats running for president.
Well, that's it. Before the show, I mentioned my news feed is telling me that Syrian kids are dying in horrible ways, and we used to care about that. And we used to get involved, at least politically or diplomatically. And now nobody even knows it. I mean, and I understand all the Trump dominates the news cycle about all this nonsense, but is it just that? You know, what should we know about Syrian kids dying, number one? I'm going to get my other question in here because this is a favorite topic of Steve. Number two, a gentleman from the Netanyahu administration said this yesterday on my newsfeed that what unites their side is hate. And certainly I see a connection between the Trump administration and the Netanyahu administration in the uniting force being hate, fear of the other, fear of minorities. And third, how important it is if Netanyahu loses the election today?
Yes, March 2nd is supposed to be the election.
How important is that?
Let's go to the first question first, because Paul's written a book on the Syrian crisis. Paul, tell folks what the name of your book is and what your focus is. And it came out, a couple of years ago?
It came out last year.
Last year.
Yeah, it's called Syrian Forced Migration and Public Health in the European Union. So it examines the consequences of the Syrian refugee crisis for the neighboring states of the Middle East, but also potentially in Europe. From the influx of refugees. And so to answer your first question, it's one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes ever, the Syrian refugee crisis. And the problem is that this Syrian conflict has become a large proxy war for power and influence in the Middle East. And as a result of some poor decisions within the Obama administration, as a result of Trump's kind of backing off in what we call in the literature offshore balancing, where you essentially take a step back, allow for leaders in the region, you know, to fight for you. So, support of rebel groups, you know, and using the militaries in the region to do the fighting, you have this increased fighting that's allowed the Russians, allowed the Iranians to maintain an influence. And expand their influence. But one of the worst things that happened was our treatment of the Kurds. You know, when we were supposed to support, we had been supporting them, and they were the most effective fighters that we had on the ground in Syria. To withdraw them, you know, that's hurt American credibility in trying to bring a solution to this conflict. And that ties actually directly to your second and third question, because the Trump peace plan for the Arab-Israeli conflict has basically, it's been a one-sided deal that benefits the state of Israel, because it allows for Netanyahu to continue his partnership with these far-right religious parties that, you know, they essentially ran in a runoff last year in an election. So they, you know, had to postpone a new election until this month. But if he wins that election, that will allow for Israel to dictate the terms in this plan to annex the Jordan Valley, to continue the building of settlements. And basically it says for the Palestinians that they have to meet six objectives about not committing violence, about disarming Hamas in the Gaza Strip. All of these conditions are predicated on whether the Israeli government and the United States government say that the Palestinians are doing this.
So it couldn't be more one-sided, right?
Correct.
It couldn't be. Is it even an attempt to really negotiate peace, or is it just for show, or is it just to default, give the Israelis everything that they want, even if that's going to cause, because understand there's about 10 million Palestinians out there. So it you would think that down the line there would be a problem.
Well, it's not to give them everything that they want. What's happened is that there's still disagreements between the Trump administration and the Israeli government, or at least the interim government, over how much land they can take in the Jordan Valley, because there's still a commission that's been put together with Kushner at the head to negotiate how much land they can actually take back. They haven't fully committed to a specific number yet, so there's still negotiations going on.
The president's son-in-law.
Correct. Yeah. Yes, Jared Kushner.
And foreign policy mind of the
That's out of your mouth, not mine.
Yeah.
No, but I mean
sarcasm. Go ahead.
I mean, the number of unqualified people in the American foreign policy establishment now is just astonishing. I mean, we saw it with the whole thing in Ukraine, this sort of crazy mishmash. Trump seems to only care about how Trump looks, and so in that sense, how does this foreign policy proposal do it? In other words, he doesn't really care whether Joe Biden's son got extra money they didn't deserve or something like that. He doesn't care about that. He cares about causing enough of a problem so that for political reasons, like Hillary's emails. So 2 years later, you find out that she didn't do anything particularly, certainly nothing legally wrong. But it's 2 years later, and he was able to use that as a campaign thing. Is this going on in with our Middle East policy?
Well, you know, it's the Trump administration. The Trump administration, as you both know, is known for doing that type of thing. But I must say that it's generally the political appointees that the Trump administration has put in, you know, that are the ones that are trying to appeal to Trump's what seems like his own personal agenda and not the interests of American foreign policy. You know, because I know for a fact there are a number of diplomats, you know, in the State Department and bureaucrats down in the foreign policy establishment, you know, that they don't believe any of this at all. They're doing their jobs day in and day out.
That's their job.
Yeah, it's their job. So it's important to make that distinction between the career foreign service officers and, you know, political appointees.
So what's the function of this peace plan? It gives Trump some sort of political the timing of it is some sort of political triumph right before the election. I mean, there's that probably figured
that's the
in.
Major criticism of it, that it was released at this point in the fall of 19 to distract from the impeachment trial, and then that was the economic plan, and now the political plan was released in January of this year. Many are arguing that it was done in the build-up to the election, so he could have a positive.
So they introduced this plan with all this fanfare, and it just dropped dead in the water. And it just, nothing seemed to happen. I think part of it, the problem with Netanyahu is in some trouble. He's been indicted and he has problems with his election.
Yes.
So he couldn't respond to it the way he probably would want to. But it kind of just kind of put it out there, and then it just sort of disappeared, at least from public view.
Well, and that's for two reasons. It's the Israeli domestic politics, because they're still waiting to see what the results of the election will be, because if he wins, then it's likely that this will move forward. But there was also a very tepid response from our allies in Europe. The Palestinians rejected it, both the leader of the PLO as well as the Palestinian Authority, Saeb Erekat, I'm blanking on his name right now.
Mm-hmm. Him.
Yeah, him.
That guy.
But anyway, both of the head Palestinian leaders, Mahmoud Abbas was his name, and then also the Saudis and a number of the Arab leaders have also denounced the plan as well.
So what the plan amounts to is putting a squeeze on the Palestinians in every way possible and giving them almost nothing except right at the end. I have a terrible feeling, Paul, which would always bother me, and tell me this is not true, is that the less violent the Palestinians have been, the more they've lost, the more things have gone against them. They had the most attention and the most, I guess, bad attention back in the days when there was more fighting. And since they sort of laid down their arms, and then the situation with Palestinians has just gotten worse.
I would disagree with that. I would say that they actually haven't laid down their arms. Maybe, you know, certain factions of the Palestinians.
Yeah, like tell me it's not true, Paul.
The Palestinian Authority, you know, renounced violence, but you still have groups like Hamas as well as Islamic Jihad that are continuing to use violence. And because of that, that's what's increased Israeli response, you know, to try and stamp out these terrorist acts.
But since they sort of signed the peace accord, maybe it's just the power relation. They just sort of ended up with nothing. They have a sort of occupied state. They don't control the air. They don't control the sea. They don't control anything that a normal state would control, and this new plan would make that absolutely permanent, I guess.
That's exactly what they're wanting to do. They're wanting to put all of the power into the Israeli government's hands, because literally, for, you know, historically for 100 years, the West has never trusted Palestinians.
Right.
That's my reading of it. They do not trust
the intentions. Well, they were brown people, you know, and that, I think that was part of it. They didn't trust anybody in the Middle East.
But even today, though, Steve, their policies they're always conditioned, and they were conditioned in the past on Palestinians must always do something first. The Israeli government could never do something first. It would always say, well, no, we'll react and do something once the Palestinians do it. You know, it was always putting the onus on the Palestinians to make peace first, instead of the Israeli government trying to give something up and the Palestinians then responding in kind.
And just one more question to follow up. And this has been traditional with American foreign policy. It's not something that's changed with the Trump administration. The idea that Palestinians can't be trusted, the Palestinians have to give in to what the Israelis want, is American foreign policy since the state was formed.
Right, in 48.
Well, yes, at the top of the show, you said you track that very little has changed. Maybe there was more positive rhetoric about Palestinians in previous administrations and not so obvious one-sidedness or more diplomacy, but it hasn't changed through Democratic and Republican administrations much. But I want to make so you're talking about complete Palestinian capitulation here. On
politically, they'll be, it seemed to me, and Paul can correct me because you know more about this than I do.
Looked
to me from the plan, Mike, that politically the Palestinians completely capitulate, and in return they get some economic goodies.
But Steve, they were not a part of these negotiations, so they're not capitulating. It's in the plan.
But that's what the demand.
Yeah, that's a good point.
No, but it's the United States and Israel dictating that you must capitulate.
Yeah.
The Palestinians were not invited to these negotiations. This was Kushner and his team working with the Israeli government to develop this plan so that Israel would benefit 100%.
So what are the chances of something like that actually leading to peace?
I don't think it will lead to peace. Yeah. You have to have all parties involved in the negotiations for there to be peace. You know, with all of the Palestinians not being – with the entire Palestinian community not being involved, you can't have peace. Even your enemies, you must negotiate with them at some point to find terms that you all can live with, especially in this region, you know, especially in this particular area. Because there's still disagreements over where the Palestinian capital will be.
Yeah.
In the peace plan, it says, oh, it's going to be a bit east of East Jerusalem. Now, historically, the Palestinians, as you both know, want Jerusalem to be their capital.
Right.
The West has always said, well, no, we'll potentially talk about East Jerusalem. Now, this plan is changing that to say, well, no, you can't have East Jerusalem proper because there are Jews that live there. You must have some of the slum that's on the eastern outskirts with some settlements and then the border wall there. That will be your capital.
And it just gets worse and worse for the Palestinian. Is there anybody in the government or that would like to see something fair in the Palestinian and Israeli dispute? Is there like to see a fair settlement, or is even the word fair kind of, Mike, is that just a weird word outer space?
The couple of Israelis that I know, the people that live and travel to and from the USA to Israel, believe that there is, like there is here, an incredible majority against these plans. A majority of Israelis, led by a minority government, that want to find a route to peace, to give Palestinians more autonomy, to live in harmony with their neighbors, not dominate them, and certainly not kill them or eliminate them through genocide. I'm seeing in a lot of, and this is, maybe there's lots of flaws with this, but I'm seeing a parallel between Israel's reaction or actions in the last 50 years and the U.S. to Native Americans over that whole period, where you've taken their nation, and you are telling them what they can and can't do with it, and then, and also, by the way, killing them as often as and as much as possible.
So when we look at the Arab-Israeli thing, what we get in Trump is just the other plans the United States has issued have always been biased for Israel. But this was a super bias for Israel, and giving the Palestinians nothing and not even having them part of the negotiation. Plus, we have Israel deeply involved in Syria now. They must have killed hundreds, if not thousands, of Iraqi Shia militia in Syria who have not directly
Iranian,
attacked
Iranian.
Iranian. Oh, what did I say?
He said Iraqi.
Oh, all right. Sorry. Yeah.
Well, you have to. Another thing that you haven't mentioned is that Israel is also partnering with Saudi Arabia against Iran. So they have actually increased their ties in the last couple of years to challenge Iranian influence in the Middle East.
Where is the Saudi desperation to fight Iran, which seems in a weak position, come from? I mean, why are they so desperate? So they're secretly allied with Israel and the United States, and they're getting all these other Emirates and stuff to come on board, and they want to have a huge fight with Iran, I think because Iran's weak, but that's just my take on it.
Well, how much time do you have? That's a very complicated answer.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of different components to it, but I will try and give
all
you
right.
a,
Let
I'll give you
an
a rate.
Example of
okay.
Yemen. All
okay.
right. Yemen, you have a Shia minority, lives in the mountains of northern Yemen, persecuted, displaced, bypassed, everything you can think of for generations. There's a civil war. They come out on top. Suddenly, it's in a big Iranian conspiracy, and I know the Iranians are helping them, but it gets lensed from being a local conflict where there's a failure of the government of Yemen, And so that a minority group, I think, I don't know, 40%, whatever, of Yemen is Shia, takes over. And then it becomes it gets turned into this big Saudi Emirate.
Well, another proxy
Iran.
War.
It's a proxy war. Exactly.
Well, you know, think about it from the perspective of the Iranians. You know, Persia was a great empire. The Safavids before them were a great empire. So they have a perception of themselves as a great people. And right next door to them, you have for many years Sunnis in the Ottoman Empire. Then later, after the British and French are there, constantly setting these different sects against each other. You have these new states develop where there's minority-majority politics, increasing the amount of conflict in the region. So for the Saudis, this is about power politics, about because they have the wealth and oil, because they have the backing of the United States, the main superpower since 1945, this was an opportunity for them to try and support the Sunnis and the various Sunni groups around the Middle East. So in response, a natural reaction, if you look at it from Iran, you know, you have these Sunni groups to your west. You have the Gulf Emirates, which are also Sunni, to your just to your south. And you have these international powers that are trying to take what has been a part of the land and resources of the Middle East for their own purposes. So for the conflict itself is about protecting what they view as their security.
So without understanding history and these empires, the Ottoman Empire, the Persian, 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago, then understanding anything in the Middle East becomes really difficult because it is about religion, and that is probably as foreign, at least it used to be, as foreign to Americans as anything. To see this these decisions being made, decision after decision, policy decisions, fighting decisions on aggression, over religion, over reaching out to your brethren and forgetting about borders, forgetting about political borders, and going back to these ancient ties, which it's all based on religion. For some of us, now, let me throw this in. Joe Biden in 2003 wanted to divide Iraq into three, which people laughed at the time, but now it doesn't seem so stupid to maintain at least some balance of power between Shias and Sunnis in the Middle East.
And the Kurds, yeah.
Divide Iraq into three sections. If you're going to invade a country, if you're going to invade a sovereign nation in the Middle East under some pretense of weapons of mass destruction or anything else, he tried to kill my dad, all the other silly things, reasons we invaded Iraq. And I'm not trying to mitigate American pain and suffering and loss and the brave people that did U.S. policy there. That's not the boy. We're talking foreign policy here. And so now it doesn't seem so dumb.
Well, you also have to think about the three regions were broken up, the Kurds would have a large percentage of the oil and gas, as would the Shia and others in the south. You know, what's going to happen with the central part of this country? You know, they don't have an economic wellspring. So as a result, there's going to be increased fighting. And so, who does the United States support? Do we support the Kurds in the north? Do we support the Sunnis or do we support the Shia?
Well, for our foreign policy was supporting Shias and Kurds.
Right, but that those were trying to keep them all together. Keeping them in a state of Iraq. But if we followed your line of thinking and you broke up the country into three separate states, it would actually increase the presence of the United States in the region because then we would have to support multiple states against one particular state.
So let me shift this a little bit just to ask you, Paul, a more general question. What takeaways on the Middle East would you, if you had four or five takeaways that you wanted American public to absorb on the Middle East? What lessons, what ideas, what policies would you think those would be?
Well, I would say that politics in the Middle East is very, very complicated, that it's about power politics, that currently it's about strategy and economic exploitation, and what's sorely missing is foreign policy that incorporates human rights, you know, that is going to support indigenous communities and helping to stop a lot of these conflicts. We're not concerned about stopping these conflicts because these conflicts benefit our oil and gas companies, you know, that are seeking to exploit the oil and gas in Syria as well as in Iraq.
So there's a lot of resources at play. Mike mentioned earlier the renewed fighting in Syria, the last province of Syria controlled by rebel groups, mostly extremely violent Sunni Muslim groups, you know, basically Al-Qaeda-type folks fighting against the almost equally evil Syrian government. And that's led to a new burst of the kind of fleeing of Syria that you talked about in your book, and horrible carnage that Mike was referring to. We're now seeing, you know, I don't know, all the wars end up to killing a lot of children. And
let me we're talking to Paul Lenz, distinguished professor of Middle East stuff, and author of
scientific name,
Middle East stuff.
Thank you. That's actually what my PhD is.
Yeah, Middle East stuff.
Middle East stuff.
Everybody else has international. Yeah, Middle East stuff. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm a linguist. so we want to, but I do want to mention that you've written a number of books about the Middle East, and certainly this is Sedona, and we have a community of writers here. We have, and so you have accomplished the thing that many people are working on here. So, and you've taken your knowledge and your, I'm passionate, obviously, from listening to you talk for the last 40 minutes. This is not a subject that you are impassionate about. Tell us a little bit about the writing process and your research process. Where does all this come from?
That's a good question. I've always been fascinated by the Middle East and international politics. So my dad was a American military officer. He was an advisor to the Saudi Royal National Guard back in the late 70s. And so as a baby, I got to swim in the Red Sea. So I got to hear stories about Saudi Arabia. So that kind of developed an interest in history and the Middle East. So I decided that I wanted to learn about that. And that's what I went to college for, was to learn about international politics and read and write about the Middle East. But I wrote, because I've always been interested in democratization and how countries become democratic. I lived in Germany when the Berlin Wall came down, so that sparked an interest in democracy. So when I got into political science as a discipline, I learned about democracy, learned about militaries because I had an interest in security issues in the Middle East. So that's what I wrote my dissertation on, was militaries in the Middle East, which was the first book, Civil Military Relations in the Islamic World.
And it's about the relationship of the militaries to the politics of the country.
Exactly, right. And why they overthrow governments, such as the dynamics that occurred around the Arab Spring. So for my writing process, it was developing – thinking about, all right, what are the issues that are going to impact the Middle East moving forward? And so when I got here 10 years ago, I set out to write some more about Egypt, to learn about Egypt, and then incorporated that into a book proposal and got the first book written. And then I was friends with student in Washington State University where I was working on my PhD. She ended up getting a PhD in public health, and so she had this idea of wanting to write about the refugees and the public health issue. So I said, well, let's look at the Syrian civil war because that's the most timely. So I've been lucky in that the topics that I pick have all been timely, hence they've been able to get published. So with my writing process, it's a lot of looking at what's happening in the news issues and trying to see, okay, how does this relate to the academic literature that's been written? And then kind of develop papers first, present them at conferences, get feedback from my fellow academics, and then try and turn that into a proposal for a book. And then
don't forget it.
These are it's a 2-year-long process of getting the from idea to finished book is generally, for me, about 2 years.
I see. Okay, well, that's it. But you get the ball over the finish line, as they say, or the goal line, or whatever
right.
whatever metaphor I'm mixing.
And he publishes a book about every 2 years, two to 3 years, don't you?
Yeah, and I'm working on a book now on the decline of American power. That's my project that I'm going to start writing this summer.
Tell us a little bit about what the perspective is on that. And we've got
The argument that I'm making in the book is that the George W. Bush administration, the Obama administration, and the Trump administration all have the same neoliberal foreign policy, promoting American national interests, so self-determination, protection of oil and gas, the basically American power around and interests around the world. And as a result of the various policies that have happened in Europe, you know, with something like Ukraine, or in the Middle East with the Iraq War, with the Syrian Civil War, Iran, the relationship with Iran and the Saudis, and in Asia, trying to balance the power of China, that's led China and Russia to have a resurgence around the world. You know, and so, you know, I'm going to call the book Searching for Monsters to Destroy, based off of the John Quincy Adams speech, the decline of American power in a multipolar world. So I'm basically arguing about how American power has declined from 2001 to 2020 and how China and Russia are going to be forces in the world for the next few years.
And you're blaming neoliberalism.
Blaming neoliberalism as the basis of our capitalist economy and our foreign policy.
From the really, I guess, cynical but just sort of perspective, I mean, Russia really played their hand well in Syria compared to what the U.S. did.
Yeah.
We managed to betray our allies.
Well, they played their hand well in the 2016 election.
I mean, in a horrible way. Puppet. I don't mean in a good way.
Traitor that's just, in the White House.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just I was talking to a veteran of who had spent some time in Vietnam, and he said, "Well, betraying allies is not, you know, something new in American foreign policy. We betrayed the South Vietnamese, you know," and he went on and on and on, or he didn't go on and on, but he said, "You know, viewing our betrayal of our Kurdish allies is something. It's not like." The United States has this – we betrayed the Kurds a couple of times in the sense of abandoning them in their search for whatever they – so it's not – you don't want to approach American policy too idealistic rose-colored lenses, right, Paul?
No, I'm a political scientist. We never look at the world idealistically. For me personally, I look at it realistically.
You would consider yourself a realist
I'm a neo-realist with constructivist tendencies.
Oh my gosh.
Which means that I look at individuals as well.
That in 2 minutes.
On that bit of fog, we will hold it for a second. I want to talk about, thanking, I want to talk about, the people behind us here, Claudia Clark and Kat Ginzel, critical in the meetings. If you want to have more democratic stuff besides this wonderful conversation this morning. March 17th in Cottonwood at the old town Red Rooster Cafe, 901 North Main. We have meetings. They have meetings. The Yavapai Democratic Party-Cottonwood is in actually, you guys have changed their name to Verde Valley Democrats, I believe.
Yeah, they have changed their name. I thought that's a good change.
At any rate.
The other was a little awkward.
At any rate, on Tuesdays at 4 o'clock if you want to eat, 5 o'clock if you want to just to get the business meeting. The speaker will be announced. We'll be talking. Obviously, there's lots to talk about. Democrats of the Red Rocks have their breakfast on March 19th. Cottonwood on March 17th. Democrats of the Red Rocks right here in Sedona on March 19th. St. Joseph's Day, by the way. We got St. Patrick's Day. So Cottonwood's have it on St. Patrick's Day. Sedona's have it on St. Joseph's Day. St. Joseph's is like one of those Italian things that it was a holiday designed around eating, which how could it be better? Nothing could be better. St. Joseph tables all over the neighborhood.
Little Italy was amazing. Yes, yes. The parades and stuff are pretty impressive.
So don't forget, you got Democracy on the Corner right here in Sedona. on Fridays from 3 to 4. We have people out there demonstrating. We need about 4 or 5 million more to actually impact the Trump administration, so the experts tell us. Thanks, folks. Don't forget, VVID.org. We'll have a podcast of this show, VVID.org, our podcast.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.